Welcome back to the Heidi Harris Show. I am thrilled to welcome Frazier Heston, if you recognize the last name. Of course, he's the son of Charlton Heston and an actor in his own right. By the way, he played the baby Moses. That's hilarious. We'll get to that story. Frazier Heston, welcome to the Heidi Harris Show.
Thanks, Heidi. It's great to be here.
Well, you grew up in the industry. Obviously, you're a filmmaker yourself. What an interesting past you had on the set. Certainly, you played Baby Moses. Then you were on the set of Ben-Hur in your little gladiator outfit. I've seen pictures of you in that little thing. It had to be a heck of a life growing up with the Heston family.
You know, it was a great childhood. I consider that I kind of won the parent lottery. Both my parents were Greatest Generation Midwesterners, really down-to-earth folks, good people, kind, gracious, considerate, good family people, and just really nice guys. And they wanted to spend time with the family. So Dad took me and my sister Holly, who's 7 years younger than I am, all around the world as we were growing up. And yes, that included the set of Ben-Hur and El Cid, and even the, in my case, Ten Commandments, which was my both my acting debut and swan song. I got to precede my dad on screen as Moses, but I didn't get first billing, unfortunately.
That's so funny because your mother was pregnant at the time, and when you were born, Cecil B. DeMille said, congratulations, he's got the part. He knew how old
That's
you were
right.
going to be.
Yeah, I got that telegram somewhere.
That's great. Now, by the way, how's your mom?
She's great. 93 years old, Lydia Clark Heston, going strong, professional photographer, a terrific woman.
Yeah, she is. And, you know, it was interesting. I just recently read, literally like 2 weeks ago, Mark Elliott's biography of your father. Read the entire thing. I was fascinated by it. I thought it was very, very well done. Your parents started out very young. They were both actors. They had virtually nothing. I mean, they were lucky if they had hot water when they first started out. And it's so important for people to understand, as you mentioned, their Midwest roots and the fact that they were really solid people.
Well, you know, that's exactly right. After the war, which kind of put a big pause in everybody's career, Dad came back from the Aleutian Islands, where he was stationed in the Air Force, flying B-25 bombers in the North Pacific, and survived that miraculously, helped to save the free world, and comes home, and they have absolutely nothing. So they, what do? They move to New York to become starving actors. They lived in a little cold water walk-up flat in Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah, that was a heck of a story. And they were married how many years?
About 65 years.
This is incredible. It really, truly is. And you're a filmmaker in your own right. We're going to get to that. What I did not realize until I had read Mark Elliott's biography, certainly I knew who your father was and watched many of his movies, kind of grew up with him, everything from The Ten Commandments, Ben-Hur, to Gray Lady Down, all these movies that he was in. I did not realize that your father had stood up for civil rights long before it was cool. That was something that wasn't mentioned in his latter years very often.
Well, you know, that's exactly right. And the title of Mark's biography, the subtitle is Hollywood's Last Icon, Charlton Heston, Hollywood's Last Icon. So there are these kind of iconic moments that you know my father for, Ten Commandments, holding up the staff, who's on the Lord's side, let him come to me. And Ben-Hur and El Cid and Planet of the Apes, all of those great iconic moments. But then there are these politically iconic moments, Dad working with Ronald Reagan, helping to elect George W. Bush, and serving as president for 3 terms of the National Rifle Association. But between him holding up the staff as Moses and holding up the Kentucky flintlock as president of the NRA, there was a lifetime of public service and service to his country, his art, his fellow artists. He helped to found the American Film Institute. He served as president of the Screen Actors Guild after Reagan left the board. And, of course, he did march to the steps of the Lincoln Memorial with Dr. Martin Luther King leading the arts contingent. And he was very, very proud of all those things and saw them all as basically a defense of freedom and a defense of the Constitution and service to his country.
Very true. We're speaking with Frazier Heston, who's a filmmaker in his own right and the son of Charlton Heston. Is it true that when your sister came home, you said, can we sell her?
Yeah, I probably did. We would have gotten a good price for her. She was awfully cute.
And I know you and your sister are very, very close.
Yeah, yeah, we're best friends, and we talk all the time. She's a great gal, lives in New York, has got 2 kids, Ridley and Charlie, and just a really wonderful woman.
I wanted to mention a book that your father wrote. He's written more than one, of course, and this one I got a few years ago, and I just love that. It's called To Be a Man, and it was written to your son, Jack.
Yeah, that's right. Jack, who is now a third-generation filmmaker. By the way, happy birthday, Jack. It's his 26th birthday today.
That's great.
Hard to believe. Dad wrote this book kind of about his relationship with his grandson and what he thought he could pass on to his grandson.
Yeah, it's a great book. I loved it, and I've got a copy on my shelf, and I recommend everybody read it. It's called To Be a Man. It was excellent. Now, when Mark Elliott approached you, he's written a lot of great biographies of some really great people. When he approached you about writing this, did you know much about him? Did you feel comfortable with the information he was going to get from you writing this book about your dad?
You know, I was familiar with his work, Clint Eastwood biography, John Wayne, Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Stewart, et cetera, et cetera. But once I met him, I realized that he had no political agenda. Mark is not a conservative, but he had no agenda whatsoever. He wanted to tell a good story and to research it in a way that had never been done before. And he knew that the best way to do that, really the only way, is to get access to the family, to our archives, and obviously get my sister and I to give him interviews that were, you know, the only ones who were in a position to really tell him what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very forthcoming with him. We decided to open up the archives. We really didn't restrict anything. We gave him all the photos that are in the book. And it was a wonderful experience for us. He researched it for almost 2 years and spent another year writing the book. And when I got the manuscript in manuscript form, double spaced, it was about 1,000 pages. And I thought, well, there's got to be a pony in here somewhere. But fortunately, there was a whole stable of them. And I really, really liked the book a lot. He showed me a lot of things that I didn't know about my dad, like how he fought Ronald Reagan after Reagan became president with his help to save funding for the National Endowment for the Arts, which in turn funded the American Film Institute. And he felt it was really important for the AFI to be able to preserve our great films. We wouldn't have the films that we see on TBN and TNT every week if it wasn't for the American Film Institute. They'd all be dust by now.
That's important.
And Dad realized how important it was to put a little federal money into the art of film, which is, after all, the American art form.
I did not realize till I read Mark Elliott's book the battles your father had with Ed Asner. I guess I just was not aware. Maybe it was an inside Hollywood thing more than anything else, but they went at it, the two of them.
They really did. I mean, Mr. Asner is a wonderful actor. He's beloved by everybody. He's a funny guy, and he's a nice guy. But he just didn't, you know, he rubbed Dad the wrong way, and Dad rubbed him the wrong way. So Asner's a committed liberal, and good for him. You know, it's good that we have that kind of dialogue in this country, and I hope that will always be the case. But he really took it personally, and so they kind of, you know, went at it hammer and tongs in a couple of debates, mainly to do with SAG and you know, a more liberal vision of how that union should be run.
Yeah, that's true. We're speaking with Fraser Heston. Is it, and it's, it sounds kind of a crazy question, but as a kid, I'm sure Heston was a great last name to have. As an adult, as a filmmaker in your own right, is it better or worse to have the name Heston? Do you feel like you have to work harder than the next guy to prove how great you are because of the last name? Or do you feel like doors are open for you because of the last name and how much experience you had growing up watching all this?
Well, you know, first of all, you get to do interviews like this one, which is, by the way, awesome. I think being able to do radio is the coolest thing in the world. It's a 100-year-old medium.
That's true.
And or more, and we're still using it. It was the internet of its time. And I hope it'll be around forever. And here I am talking to your audience. I can say just about anything I want.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's undoubtedly an advantage. But there are disadvantages, too. People tend to literally prejudge you about certain things. And, you know, usually once they get to know me, that they know I'm the sweetest guy in the world. and there were other advantages, too, like growing up on movie sets. You pick up a lot about how a set's run.
Right.
How things are actually done, how special effects are rigged, how important safety is in stunt work, how important it is to cover your actors with different close-ups and different angles, and how movies are actually put together on the grassroots level. And that's where I learned my filmmaking skills. I never went to film school.
No question. We're speaking with Fraser Heston. One of the things about Ben-Hur I also didn't realize is how many weeks he spent trying to learn from the stuntmen how to drive the chariots. And there was a funny thing in there. And he said, well, I'm not sure I'm going to beat these other guys. And the director said, I'll be sure you win the race. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, that was Yakima Nutt, the second unit director.
That's funny.
Said, Chuck, you just stay in the dang chair, and I guarantee you're going to win the dang race.
But that's not easy to do, even if that's not what you do professionally. He spent a lot of time trying to learn how to drive that chariot.
You better believe it. I remember driving in the chariot with him. He used to take me for rides around the arena, and there's some photographs of that in the book, in fact.
What a cool upbringing. You got to see things that were just amazing. And not only that, you know, movies like Ben-Hur, those were some of the last huge, great films of that era.
Well, you know, the cool thing about Dad's career, when you think about it, he kind of reinvented himself and different genres every decade. You know, in the 50s, it was epics. It was Ten Commandments, Greatest Show on Earth, both directed by Cecil B. DeMille, Say No More, Ben-Hur, a much more modern kind of epic directed by William Wyler. And then in the 60s, he was doing smaller films like Will Penny, A Wonderful Western, his favorite film, a little Paramount movie he did. Planet of the Apes, when they weren't making science fiction movies. They hadn't made one since the 50s. And that makes it possible for films like 2001, A Space Odyssey, and Star Wars to get made.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And also Earthquake. He also ushered in an era of disaster movies.
Disaster films, exactly right. And then he goes in the 80s, he goes and does Midway, grosses more than $100 million, and here comes more World War II films.
Exactly. Just follow Heston to know what movies are going to be successful, right?
And the good news is, and we got, you know, as his career went on, obviously offers for leading men started to thin out, as is normally the case. And we formed our own production company in 1981, Agamemnon Films. I said, Dad, listen, we got to be producing these things. I can get financing. We can do some with you. I'll direct and write some. Let's get a business going. So we started our production and distribution company back in the early 80s and started making both features and cable films for TNT and ABC and other companies.
Yeah, that one. I know you were doing that, and that's the way to do it, really, to have more control over the product and have more control over the scripts brought to you or just every aspect of what's happening.
Yeah. Nowadays, every actor from Brad Pitt to Tom Cruise has got their own production company. Reese Witherspoon, for example, is famous for finding interesting books and bringing them to the screen. And that's just de rigueur. But in those days, it wasn't done much, and Dad didn't really care about the notoriety. He didn't care. He never took a producing credit. He did direct a couple of films. He directed Antony and Cleopatra in 1973, the Shakespearean version. He directed a film that I wrote called Motherlode, which was our first Agamemnon production.
Talk about 1960 when your dad won the Oscar and he mentioned one of the writers of a film who had passed away, and that was real controversial at the time.
Well, he mentioned Christopher Fry, and I don't know if he had actually passed away at that point, but he was not a Guild writer, and he was an Englishman. And the Guild basically said they wouldn't consider him for Academy Award consideration. The original writer, and I think he was rewritten by Gore Vidal, in fact. They had a huge contribution, but they were credited writers, and Christopher Fry wasn't. He was a wonderful English playwright. And Dad thought his contribution was worthy of notice. And when he mentioned him, he just thanked him in his Academy Awards speech. You wouldn't believe the controversy that ensued.
Isn't that ridiculous how protectionist they can be? They claim to be so tolerant in Hollywood, right? And they are the most protectionist, intolerant crowd out there.
I wouldn't disagree with that.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. Now, the house that Herb built is the house that you grew up with, and they called it the house that Herb built. It was a beautiful home. I understand you sold it a couple of years ago. That had to be tough for the family.
Yes. It was time to move on. Mom was not living there anymore, and it was definitely, you know, I wasn't going to move into it. My sister wasn't going to move into it, so it was definitely time to sell it. We did, and it was certainly painful to move out of a place that my parents had been living in since 1959.
Yeah, that is amazing. And I know it had a beautiful view and all that, the pool and the tennis court and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. We're speaking with Frazier Heston. A couple other things I wanted to talk to you a little bit about. Obviously, we talked about your dad and some of the things that he did that were so incredible. Let's talk about your future and the things that you're doing, because I know you're a film director, filmmaker, I should say. What have you got in the pike? What kind of things interest you? What are you seeing in Hollywood now for the future?
Well, to answer your first question, we have a couple of very different kinds of projects in the pipeline. A couple of years ago, we released a documentary about the disappearance of Michael Rockefeller, who was Nelson Rockefeller's son who disappeared in New Guinea amongst the cannibals, literally, in 1961, and may have been possibly eaten himself, without exaggeration, or may have survived several years in the jungle. He was seen from time to time, I guess like Elvis. And we found a cache of lost footage taken by a magazine editor who went down there to try to find him. And he didn't find Michael, but he found a great story. And so we made a documentary out of his lost footage and crafted a new film out of it. He'd never done anything with the film. Then I realized once we finished the documentary that we had to turn this into a feature film. So that's a project that we're just finishing up the script on, my writing partner Heather McAdams and I. In fact, I'm looking at my last draft right in front of me right now, so I have to hit the typewriter later this week.
Is that the toughest part of movie making, is from the time that you conceive an idea to the time you get it on the screen? It just seems interminably long sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, as I've often said, it only takes three things to be a good filmmaker. You need a good story to tell, a burning desire to tell it, and the skin of a rhinoceros. And by which is to say, you know, this morning I woke up to an email where a producer that I had been writing a script for suddenly changed his mind and passed on it. And I just thought, wow, that's a reversal. But you know what? You just got to go on in stride and hit the ground running. Mm-hmm. A little bit like Jordan Spieth at the British Open the other day. You know, he didn't give up on that shot, and we can't either.
You have to just keep going. We're speaking with Fraser Heston, filmmaker and, of course, son of Charlton Heston. When you see Hollywood cranking out the same things again and again, what are we up to? Fast and Furious 14? What is it now? Do you just think, is there nobody who has any ideas? I mean, you talked about the documentary that you've done, and I know you've done some things that are very creative, but do you feel like most of Hollywood's just out of ideas?
You know, I think it's just become a different business paradigm or different business model. In the old days, the studios controlled everything, right? All the power was in the hands of five studios. Then it changed a little bit. The big agencies came online, CAA, ICM, William Morris. They started running the business. And to a certain extent, they have as much, if not more, power than the studios do. But then we saw the emergence of cable companies like HBO, still a giant in the entertainment business, Showtime, etc., TNT. We did the first film for Ted Turner at TNT, A Man for All Seasons. And now you have the streaming services like Netflix and Amazon. And for me to have one of my films on Netflix year before last was an eye-opener for me. I thought, wow, here's a film we made as a theatrical documentary. We assumed it would get shown on cable somewhere. Who buys it? Netflix. And they're obviously a prime mover for, you know, any future projects, including our feature version of the Rockefeller film. So it's a different world. And I have to say, I'm learning a lot about this from my son, Jack, who, as I said, is also he's a third generation filmmaker. And he knows more about it than I do now.
Yeah, well, it's certainly a changing world. And yeah, we mentioned Netflix and Amazon and things like that, creating their own movies. I mean, who would have ever thought? But they know what their audience wants to see. And they're, as you mentioned, they're buying these documentaries. And I watch them. I'm a documentary geek, I'll be honest with you. I love that kind of stuff on Netflix. It's pretty much all I watch.
Oh, yeah. And the line between documentary and feature is now somewhat blurred, isn't it? You have films like Paul Greengrass's movies and things like that are really, really interesting based on reality.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, also you might say that movies, as in theatrical movies, are for kids. And television, if you include the Netflixes and Amazon streaming services, are for grown-ups. So, you know, the really interesting shows to me are, whether you like Game of Thrones or House of Cards or something in that realm, or Bloodlines or something like that, those are grown-up movies that you'll never get to see in a theater.
Mm-hmm. That is very true.
The studios are just doing their tentpole movies. That's their business paradigm. And, you know, that's fine. Good for them. They spend $150 million. But, you know, for $15 million or $5 million, I can make a really interesting movie, show it on Netflix, more people will see it. And it'll be of a more grown-up subject matter.
That's true. We're speaking with Fraser Heston. Now, you've been married 30, how many years? 30?
Oh, gosh, more than I can count. A bunch.
But here's the thing that's important. You've been married a long time. I'm sure you have a great wife. Your parents showed you a great example of how to stay married in Hollywood. What would you say to people nowadays who don't seem to learn this lesson from your parents and also from you? Certainly, you're giving your children a great example of what it means like to stick with somebody and make it work.
Well, my wife, Marilyn, from Vancouver, Canada, by the way, I'm not sure she would agree with me, but I agree with my dad that the key ingredient in a good marriage is you have to be a perfect husband. I happen to be a perfect husband. So. Actually, that was my dad's line.
I'm going to use that. I'm stealing that line for the wife.
There you go. Yeah. And my mom used to say, they say, Mrs. Heston, did you ever consider divorce in your 60 some odd years of marriage? She goes, divorce, never. Murder, often.
Yeah, exactly. Give me a shovel and a gun. And that's absolutely true. Because your mother, and I don't want to gloss over the fact that your mother was an actress at one time more successful than your father was. And ultimately, she took a back seat to your father's career. And she had her own thing, photography and whatnot. But she wanted to be able to raise you kids, focus on keeping that household and travel with your father. And that, I'm sure at times was frustrating to her, much as she loved all of you. She did have to give up something she loved.
Well, I'm sure it was. I mean, she was a classically trained actress. She'd performed on Broadway. She'd performed on the stage. They both went to Northwestern, studied drama. That's where they met when he saw her sitting in front of him and reached out and started stroking her hair, which he thought was a good way to meet girls. And I guess it was. You know, she was a wonderful woman, is a wonderful woman, took us all over the world. She was the Indiana Jones of the family. Dad was a stay-at-home guy, wanted to stay home and play tennis. But she would go off and, you know, literally dragged us up the pyramid of Cheops in Cairo and up the pyramids of Chichen Itza in the Yucatan and all over the world. You know, we called it museum marching and ruin running.
That's funny.
She loved archaeology, history, culture, art. So that was her thing, and she just had this boundless energy and wanted to photograph it all.
Yeah, and if you were going to be there, that she wanted you to see all of it. I know that your grandfather, your father's father, during a divorce, was kind of separated from the family through no fault of his own for many years. And then he and your father connected again as when your father was an adult, and he actually built the house that her built.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Dad and Mom were in Detroit on some PR tour or other, and they knew that my grandfather, who my dad hadn't seen since he was 10 years old, was living in Detroit. And Lydia said, Chuck, why don't you look up in the phone book and just see if you can find a Russell Carter? Because my dad was born to Russell Carter. His original name was John Carter, and it was his mother that changed it to Charlton Heston. His father-in-law was named Heston. So they look up my grandfather in the phone book, and sure enough, he's there. He calls him up, and he says, Dad, this is Chuck. And Russell said, well, where are you? And he said, I'm in town. I'm in a hotel. He said, don't move. Stay right there. I'll be right over. He drove over. They had this great reconciliation and became very close. And indeed, my grandfather, Russ, built the house that my dad lived in for 50 some odd years.
I love that story because it sounds like it was your grandmother who pushed him away. And we're not going to get into that whole conversation, but I love the fact that they got back together after all those years. That was fantastic.
Exactly.
Where can people keep up with you, Fraser Heston?
Well, you can check out our website. It's a bit of a mouthful, but it's agamemnon.com.
Okay.
And we have all our projects and books and various things there, or you can just Google me and that'll come up.
Well, it's great talking to you, Fraser Heston. I really appreciate it. And I was wondering when I was going to talk to you, you know, you want to talk about somebody's father constantly. You know what? I'd be proud to talk about my dad for an hour too. So I know that you have your own career, your own life, things you've accomplished yourself, but I know you're always proud to talk about your dad too. And America certainly owes him a debt of gratitude in a lot of ways.
Thanks, Heidi. I agree with all of that. I think my dad was the finest man I've ever known.
Yeah. You know how many people can say that about their dads? Not as many as should be able to say that.
I hope my son says that about me, but I'm not too sure.
I'm sure he will. Thank you, Fraser. Thanks for joining us on the Heidi Harris Show. It was great to talk to you.
Thanks, Heidi. You too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.